from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Amandine Lee.
And I'm Colin Smith.
This week on War News Radio, Best of Fall 2011, we highlight some of the best work recently produced.
First, we explore the memories of 9/11.
Then, we learn about Afghanistan's opium economy.
Finally, we learn about a computer scientist analyzing global media to predict revolutions.
This is War News Radio. This September marked the 10th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks on the United States. War News Radio produced a special show focusing on remembering 9/11, and here we listen to the first segment. The events of that day left America reeling and heralded the beginning of the war on terror. Now, the young adults who experienced 9/11 as children are being called the 9/11 generation. A team of War News Radio staff members fanned out to talk to these students, and Caroline Batten examined some of the ways the tragedy has affected them.
On September 11, 2001, almost 3,000 people died in a coordinated Al-Qaeda-planned suicide attack on the World Trade Center's Twin Towers in New York City and the Pentagon. A fourth strike was planned for Washington, D.C., but when passengers intervened, the plane crashed into a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. The attack marked the beginning of a pivotal decade and the start of the longest war in American history. The day was forever seared in Americans' memories, both young and old alike. As we face the 10-year anniversary, the nation is reflecting on the aftermath of the tragedy.
The consequences of our actions are really going to be front and center on the 10th anniversary, because, you know, 10 years is a good time to look back and say, what were the implications of this?
That's Elena Reuter, a sophomore at Swarthmore College, a small liberal arts school outside Philadelphia. Reuter is one of the many young adults who witnessed the aftermath of 9/11 at a young age and grew up during what the Bush administration has coined the War on Terror. She and her peers are what a dozen news organizations, as well as President Obama, are calling the 9/11 generation. They say the 9/11 generation appears to be comprised of two groups. One group has become more civic-minded and volunteer-inspired. The other has grown apathetic and cynical, watching the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. War News Radio wanted to see whether these young adults agree with the categorization. But first, we heard from them about the role the 9/11 experience played in their childhood. Jesse Cannizzaro, a 21-year-old senior studying theater at Swarthmore, is from New York City. She was in Manhattan on September 11th and shares vivid memories about the day.
It's so engraved in my memory is this just incredibly strong smell of smoke throughout the city. You know, from uptown to downtown, it just, everything smelled completely of smoke. And I just remember walking around the city getting supplies with my parents and just the, like, coat of dust on everything. And just looking downtown and just seeing the smoke and debris and the wreckage that just stayed with the city.
Ross Adair, a 21-year-old senior now studying political science at Swarthmore, was also in New York City. He, too, remembers startling images from the day.
I remember I was walking downtown, and I remember seeing four or five people who were just walking straight up the street, and they were just covered head to toe in ash, and they looked almost kind of like zombies. They sort of had this faraway look on their face. They were obviously in shock, and, you know, at the time I didn't know what was really going on. So I'd never seen anything like that before. And I just thought it was some weird prank.
Whether or not they were in New York, many students now recall the day as one of shock and confusion. Most of them were in their class at their elementary schools when they got the news, like Becca Spiegel, now a 21-year-old senior majoring in sociology at Colorado College.
I was in sixth grade. I was sitting in my homeroom class, and we had a little TV up in the corner of the room. And, well, it was early in the morning. We'd probably just gotten to school, and all of a sudden my teacher turned on the TV, and we saw footage of the plane crashing into the second tower. And I remember just being totally confused and unable to understand what was going on. It didn't ever occur to me that this was something that was happening, you know, that was calculated and had been planned out. I just couldn't imagine what had gone wrong. Watching footage of the incident on TV and it's all of its aftermath and being kind of stunned and horrified and unsure what to make of it overall.
Like Spiegel, the majority of the students who spoke with War News Radio felt that the tragedy taught them important lessons, even if they did not at first understand just what was happening. Cannizzaro, in New York, learned how insecure her city was in that moment.
Just the very fact of knowing that my city that, like, for 11 years I thought was just, you know, indestructible, that no one could touch it, and that someone could, like, come in and destroy so much.
Diana Mask, now a senior studying communications at Susquehanna University, had loved ones in the surrounding area and was forced to confront the concepts of loss and tragedy.
My family is originally from North Jersey, and a lot of close family friends were affected by it. We lost a lot of family friends, and just hearing the stories of people whose cars were left at the train station in New Jersey who just went in for the day and never came back. Hearing the horror stories in general and just trying to understand the emotional stress and duress that these people were going through. You don't have to have an immediate family member who passed away and not to feel like you've lost a relative it's more of like an American family.
Similarly, Alex Chow, a 21-year-old chemistry major at the University of Delaware, learned about mortality for the first time.
I guess in some ways I've learned about life and death. I know that during that year, my grandfather also died. So even at a very young age, at 10, I began to learn about how fragile life is.
Clinical psychologist Lori Walsh, who was practicing in New York City at the time, explains the effect 9/11 had for most children across the country.
But a lot of kids kind of had their feeling of safety and their feeling of nothing bad kind of will ever happen to me eroded or shaken a little bit. You know, we like to give kids the sense of a firm ground beneath their feet, that they're safe. And in the United States, we've had this luxury of being able to do that for a long, long time. You know, it's a life lesson that we have to give all kids, that people die, that unexplainable things happen.
Dan Kindlin, who teaches child psychology at Harvard University and has written numerous works on the topic of generational trauma, agrees with Walsh, saying that many kids experienced a perspective shift.
Whenever there's a big historical event, you know, in my generation, it was probably the Kennedy assassination, it makes you grow up a little faster than you might have otherwise, you know, and to realize the world isn't quite as safe as you thought it was.
Adair expresses just that.
I think being at that young age and growing up extremely privileged in one of the richest countries in the world, you know, you don't think about that kind of stuff. And, you know, it opened my eyes up to a lot of different things, a lot of different conflicts that I wasn't aware of. And I think it did a lot for a lot of different people. I think sort of an idea that there is another viewpoint. And, you know, it's something I really had to understand, and I think I'm still understanding.
Chris Kazix, who was 20 years old and just entering the University of Pennsylvania at the time, says that 9/11 was a wake-up call.
I really didn't think about the outside world that much. And then all of a sudden, these people came from the other side of the world and crashed into our buildings. So it just kind of opened my eyes. Oh, there's people that have feelings towards the U.S., and I should know more about it.
Like Kazix, Sami Safiullah, a second-generation Bengali now studying anthropology at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee, was quickly maturing as a result of the tragedy. He, however, was learning about something even more personal.
At Masjid, for my Friday prayers, whatever, we had discussions where they were telling us to, you know, be safe. They were telling us that hate crimes against Muslims had increased, and they were telling us that while we should be very sad for what had happened during the attacks, we also had to be careful to watch our own backs because now we too were under danger. But I don't really think I knew what that meant, and because I was in elementary school, and nobody around me had any idea what was going on either, I was still sheltered enough that it didn't affect me at all.
For War News Radio, with Emily Bryant, John McMinn, Rosanna Kim, and Eliana Biscard Church, I'm Caroline Batten.
This is War News Radio. This fall, War News Radio produced 7 pieces on the modern Afghan economy. Here, we showcase a segment covering the nation's opium economy. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has described the nation's illicit opium problem as the single greatest challenge to long-term security, development, and effective governance of Afghanistan. Money from the opium trade funds the insurgency and undermines the legitimate government. Alan Zhao investigates to find out more about what drives this illicit economy. This piece first aired in September.
Let's start with the numbers. According to the United Nations Office of Drug and Crime, or UNODC, approximately 70,000 hectares of opium poppy were cultivated in Afghanistan in 2002. Despite its illicit status and governmental eradication efforts, production gradually increased until reaching nearly 200,000 hectares in 2007. UNODC's 2010 report estimated production steady at 90,000 hectares. The U.S. government and foreign experts have estimated the opium economy to be responsible for 30-60% of the total Afghan GDP. All of this has gone on despite the Afghan government and its international partners devoting billions of dollars in various efforts to fight opium production over the past decade. Why haven't they been successful in stopping farmers from growing opium? One reason, according to Paul Fishstein, agricultural expert and Harvard University Belfer Center fellow, is that agriculture in Afghanistan is very precarious.
Agriculture by its nature is a high-risk endeavor, and particularly in a physically and institutionally insecure environment like Afghanistan, there's a whole bunch of other risks on top of just the climate, you know, and agronomic-related risks.
Opium poppy has numerous biological advantages in Afghanistan's dry climate. It grows well with little care and without irrigation. But, Fishstein says, the market itself helps further opium's comparative advantage by reducing risk.
The structure of the opium economy, in a way, takes away some of that risk. You know, it's storable, it's not perishable, people will buy it at your farm gate. And, you know, they cover the transport and all the, you know, corruption-related expenses. So that's a way of minimizing risk.
Adam Payne, a rural development expert at the Afghanistan Research and Evaluation Unit, sums up the relationship between poor farmers and opium poppy.
It works for poor people in areas where markets are heavily fractured. You've got guaranteed purchase at the farm gate, you get credit. It's a relatively low-risk market in a high-risk environment. So there are those price incentives that are certainly there.
But farmers' decisions to grow is not the entire story. Once harvested, opium must be refined into heroin and transported to foreign markets. As Fishstein describes, who handles and profits from the heroin trafficking is no mystery.
Is opium helping to fund the insurgency, and does the insurgency facilitate the production and transport? Absolutely. There's no question about that. I don't think anyone would tell you there isn't a link.
Though opium is illegal, it is not without regulation. Gretchen Peters, investigative reporter with a decade of experience in Afghanistan, elaborates on the Taliban's almost governmental role in this illicit market.
The Taliban are actually quite successful at collecting all sorts of revenue, whether they are taxing poppy farmers, taxing labs that are processing opium into narcotics, taxing the shipments of drugs that are coming through their control zones. So the Taliban are actually quite efficient at collecting revenue from within this economy. So it would be wrong to say that in some ways that the economy is unregulated.
While it is known that opium's profits support the insurgency, Fishstein says its exact impact is unknown.
Quantifying it is problematic. The opium economy is funding the insurgency. How much is it? You know, what percentage? We don't really know. It could be, you know, is it 20%? Is it 30%? Is it 50%? Is it 60%?
However, the insurgency's role in fostering the drug trade is the result of a lawlessness in opium-producing provinces and in Afghanistan as a whole. Peters describes this relationship.
drug producers always gravitate to areas where there is a lack of governance. And this is probably the main driving factor is the fact that Afghanistan has a weak and corrupt government. And in fact, the region is populated by weak and corrupt governments. This, to me, is the biggest challenge that the international community faces.
Joel Hafenstein, a former USAID contractor, remarks on how bribes within the Afghan National Police Force show complicity in drug trafficking.
There is a hefty amount that you need to pay if you want to be appointed to be a district police chief. And you compare the amount that needs to be paid in province or district that's a major opium trafficking route, even if it doesn't cultivate, to the amount that police have to pay to get put in their positions in other districts in the country. And there's no comparison. I mean, it's very clear that the only way to afford a police captaincy is to be taking rents from the opium traffic.
Peter suspects that the corruption goes even higher.
The problem goes right to the top. In fact, there have been dozens of cases where President Karzai has, there have been dozens of cases where drug traffickers and officials involved in protecting the drug trade have actually gone through the Afghan court system, have been tried, convicted, sentenced, and President Karzai has turned around and pardoned them because they're political cronies.
But why is opium profitable in the first place? Payne argues that demand in the West for heroin is the ultimate driver of Afghanistan's opium economy.
It's a market driven by demand. The demand is in the West. Now, what other markets do we seek to address by controlling the supply rather than the demand side? So that's that fundamental driver. And the fact that it's illegal, of course, induces the price incentive because illegal markets operate in the shadows. They create profits and so forth.
And a demand will always find a supply. For the time being, Payne states, Afghanistan is the supply.
Now, if they succeed in closing it down in Afghanistan, it'll be pushed somewhere else. It won't disappear. But the market exists, and it's the demand side and the way in which the market is structured that is the key issue that drives it. Then if you add on top of that the issues of insecurity, the lack of alternatives, people in a sense trapped in a rural economy where there are very few other options, the conditions for them to move out of opium and to move out of the growing economy simply do not exist.
The international demand for heroin, the biological advantages of poppies, and the domestic political instability make Afghanistan the perfect place for growing opium. With an estimated 30-60% share of the total GDP, the opium economy in Afghanistan will continue unless there is effective intervention. For War News Radio, I'm Alan Zhao.
This is War News Radio. The Arab Spring came as a surprise for many around the world, but could it have been predicted? War News Radio's Eliana Biscard Church spoke with a computer analyst who believes he may have this ability in the near future. This piece first aired in November.
Since humans walked the earth and had language to talk about it, they have attempted to predict the future. Ancient Greek oracles and seers practiced divination. French apothecary Michel de Notre-Dame, or Nostradamus, published the prophecies in 1555, predicting future wars and catastrophes. In 1798, English scholar Thomas Malthus claimed that the world would overpopulate, as the food supply could only increase arithmetically. And in 1993, Samuel Huntington rocked the political science world with the belief that there would be a clash of civilizations resulting from individuals' cultural and religious identities. Sir Arthur Charles Clarke, a British futurist, science fiction author, and inventor, spoke of such predictions on the BBC Horizon program in 1964.
Trying to predict the future is a discouraging and hazardous occupation. If by some miracle a prophet could describe the future exactly as it was going to take place, his predictions would sound so absurd so far-fetched that everybody would laugh him to scorn.
But what if we could predict parts of the global political future, and it was not quite so far-fetched? One man is trying to do something like that. By burying himself in the news coverage written decades before the recent phenomenal Arab Spring, Khalev Litaru has found some very unique trends.
I would take all of the news coverage around the world about Egypt, so anything from any country that mentioned Egypt, and just look at the average tone, how positive overall and how negative overall that coverage was. And it turns out that that actually gives you sort of the global mood about Egypt, and it turns out that you actually see that begin plunging right ahead of the revolution.
Not only does Litaru say he was able to predict the timing of the Egyptian revolt through his retrospective analyses of global media, but he was also able to predict the same for the Tunisian revolution. Litaru is the assistant director of text and digital media and analytics at the Institute for Computing in the Humanities, Arts, and Sciences at the University of Illinois, and a center affiliate of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, also at the University of Illinois. His work first caught the eyes of the BBC on September 9th and was written about in 100 other countries, yet has received little coverage in the U.S. Litaru used an SLGI Altix supercomputer, or Nautilus, with 4 tetrabytes of memory at the University of Tennessee to analyze 100 million articles, print and broadcast, spanning 60 years. He gathered his data from local and global news sources, including vernacular-based media. For analyzing the revolutions, Litaru looked at the tone as well as the location of all media reports, regardless of subject. Mood detection searched for words such as terrible and nice, while location detection found where the story happened and where the participants were situated, and then converted the places into coordinates on a map. He derived the idea for mood detection from another field.
There's been a huge building of work over economics literature on tone predicts things. But no one had attempted to do this at scale for looking at the social world. So this was really sort of the first piece to say, you know what, tone actually isn't just for economics.
The idea for the analyses, he says, was based on the concept of information overload in society.
The project actually began with this notion of, we have so much data, news in particular, there's just so much historical and digital news data, especially today. What can we do with all that material? Can we find new interesting insights to human society?
Litaru's analyses show that aggregated global tone has strong predictive power. His supercomputer produced tone curves, as in Egypt, where he found a huge decrease in the month of January, signaling an intensifying negative global and local view of the overall situation in the country. Similarly, a tone curve for Hosni Mubarak showed global attitudes toward the leader as constantly decreasing since January 1999, and then hitting a major dip in January 2011. Litaru says this was an indication that Mubarak had lost global legitimacy. Both of these analyses help to explain the Spring Revolution in Egypt.
By using this type of data, you're able to figure out that, you know, this country's in a really different place now. So immediately you know that, you know, there's a much greater risk that something big will happen this time. Basically, the situation just needs a catalyst to go. And, you know, and that's really an idea behind this work.
Litaru explained that he has not been the only one to see the value in global attitudes represented in the news. World War II, he says, was the first time when U.S. and British intelligence services started monitoring global media.
They weren't interested in factual information. You know, as one famous quote goes, we have much better ways of figuring out which way the tanks are going than, reading about it the next day in the newspaper. But what it was used for was views.
Litaru says a brand new U.S. government agency began monitoring world news just a day before the Pearl Harbor attack in 1941.
And its very first report that it produced was a day before Pearl Harbor, and it said, you know, over the past weeks, Japan has dropped all appeals for peace. It's refocused its attention on the U.S., and it's turned sharply negative about the U.S. And sure enough, the next day we had Pearl Harbor. And, you know, what you're finding is that news media isn't perfect, but it gives you some really interesting views into what's happening around the world.
Litaru did not stop at analyzing news coverage for tone, however. He conducted another test to see how closely he could predict the location of Osama bin Laden using all the media prior to his May finding and death. It turns out that his supercomputer was able to predict bin Laden's hidden location within 200 kilometers of where he was actually found in Abbottabad.
I just scooped up all the news coverage that's been said about him over the last 30 years, and really he hasn't really been in the news until the last 10 years, and just made a map of all the locations mentioned in that news coverage. So any article anywhere in the world about bin Laden, what were the cities and mountains and hills and rivers mentioned in that? And it turns out you end up with this map of the world where all roads lead to a 200-kilometer radius around the city he was actually captured.
If predicting bin Laden's hidden location was not satisfying enough, Leetaro continued working with Global News to see what other kinds of insights he could gain. He conducted another analysis to see what areas of the world, or modern civilizations as Samuel Huntington called them, together, and which have the most interaction. The analysis showed that countries geographically close to one another tend to have the strongest connections, yet he also found that colonial ties remain prevalent, with Spain and Portugal more connected to Latin America, and France more connected to Africa, for example. Lastly, when Leetaro separated his analysis based on countries and their medias, he discovered interesting commentary on coverage biases.
When it was run against the New York Times, you ended up with this view of the world that really didn't make a lot of sense. The New York Times map, you see the entire world revolve around New York and Washington. The global map, you don't see that as much.
Leetaro explains that his analysis showed each country portraying the world based on its particular global interests and involvement. The United States, of course, showed the same.
Fascinating to see how vivid it is to see that in the New York Times, literally, no matter what's happening around the world, no matter how little it has to do with the U.S., it's being portrayed to a U.S. audience in terms of U.S. context. So, you know, as an American, what are we getting from American press?
To produce these graphs and maps requires heavy computing power and programming, but Leetaro believes his findings hold huge potential for the future.
And so the finding that worked this well was just shocking to say, basically, you know, there's something here. There's some, you know, obviously it's going to need a lot more refinement, but you know what? There's promise here. This actually has potential.
When asked about the possibility of including social media in future analyses, Leetaro, though enthusiastic about such websites and communication, is not yet sure where its place is in the whole mix. He is excited to see where such new forms for information can fit in his analyses and vision. Ultimately, Leetaro's goal is to create a website that would update every 15 minutes or so with the current trends in global news. If successful in real time, the site could encourage new policies from organizations and politicians for aid, outreach, action, and diplomacy. In some cases, it could even help to prevent violence and repression. For War News Radio, I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week is Alan Zhao. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Colin Smith.
And I'm Amandine Lee. Until next time, thanks for listening.